On today's episode of Attention Oliver, we'll be speaking with one of the highest-ranking Latinos ever to serve in the U.S. government. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss this very special episode. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Attention Oliver, the podcast for the American Latino Veterans Association. We're really excited to have you join us for this very special episode. I'm your host, Danny Vargas, Chairman and CEO of ALVA. In addition to these podcasts where you get to hear from inspiring guests, we also have a webinar series where you'll learn great information on really important topics. And keep an eye out for our future events by visiting our website, alvavets.org, and our social media channels, at alvavets. We really want to thank our sponsors for these podcasts and webinars, JP Morgan Chase, PMI, Wells Fargo, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Accenture. I ask that you please like, share, comment, and subscribe to our channel. This really, really helps. I'm pleased to introduce our special guest speaker today, Alberto Gonzalez. And thanks, Al, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Danny, I've been looking forward to this. Let's get with it.
So let me take a moment to read your bio so everyone has an idea of your background. Alberto R. Gonzalez served as the 80th Attorney General of the United States during the George W. Bush administration. Before entering public service, Gonzalez practiced business law at the Houston law firm of Vinson and Elkins. In 1995, he resigned his law partnership to serve as general counsel to the governor of Texas. After 3 years, the governor appointed Gonzalez as Texas Secretary of State. He was subsequently appointed as a justice on the Texas Supreme Court and elected by the citizens of Texas to serve a full 6-year term November 2000 general election. He served in the White House as counselor to the president from 2001 to 2005. Gonzalez is an Air Force veteran and attended the U.S. Air Force Academy. He is a graduate of Rice University and Harvard Law School. Presently, he is the Dean and Doyle Rogers Distinguished Professor of Law at Belmont University College of Law in Nashville, Tennessee, and he also serves on the ALVA Advisory Council. Again, Alberto, thanks very much for joining us today.
Danny, look forward to this conversation. Always look forward to conversing with you about anything related to the work of your organization and anything going on within this country. There's a lot going on in this country right now, for sure.
There is a lot going on, and we'll get to some of that stuff. But I think first, if we can take a few minutes to just talk about your personal journey prior to your federal government roles. If you can tell us a little bit about your family, your upbringing, and I know that, again, you served in the Air Force.
Sure. I am one of 8 children. I was born in San Antonio, Texas. I'm a proud Texan. My dad had a second grade education. My mom had a sixth grade education. And my dad, when they met, they both were migrant workers. So we grew up poor. Basically, grew up around the Houston area. I was born, as I said, born in San Antonio, but moved shortly thereafter to Houston. There were 8 children. And my dad was an incredibly hard worker, but he was an alcoholic. So we had some tough weekends, but every Monday morning, my dad would get up and go to work because he had a family to take care of. And what I really learned by watching my dad was the importance of responsibility. He knew he had a responsibility, and no matter how tough the weekends were, he would show up for work. And for my mom made sure that every Sunday we would all go to church, very devout Catholic. And so my, you know, I was introduced to religion and faith at a very, very early age. And I also learned from my mom, interest in education. She very much enjoyed school. And maybe that's where I got my interest in getting an education. So, I did well in high school. I was in the Honor Society and all that. I was an athlete, an all-district strong safety for our football team. But no one really ever talked to us about going to college. So when I graduated from high school, I enlisted in the Air Force and got my first duty assignment was Fort Yukon, Alaska. And there I was introduced to 2 Air Force Academy graduates who saw something in me and said, you know, you're a bright kid. You ought to think about going to school, and maybe you ought to think about going, getting an appointment to the Air Force Academy. And they helped me. You have to pass the physical fitness test. So they flew me down to an Army base in Fairbanks, Alaska, where I did my sit-ups, pull-ups, my 60-yard dash to make sure that I could pass minimum requirements. I hadn't taken the ACT or the SAT because I had never had planned to go to college. So the Air Force had the SAT flown up to Fort Yukon, Alaska, which is 6 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And I remember sitting alone in a room under the watchful eye of one of our captains. I was just an airman first class. And so I took the SAT. And then finally, you have to be physically fit. And so the Air Force flew up a flight surgeon from Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage. And he gave me a physical examination. And so I got an appointment. So the 1979 class, which was the last all-male class, 79 was the last all-male classes in all of our service academies, went to Colorado Springs and was fortunate enough. I was selected as the freshman class council president, did well in my studies. But my goal was to be a pilot. That was my dream. In fact, I got into the soaring program, the glider program, learned how to fly gliders after my first year. But then my eyes started turning bad, and I knew that I wasn't going to become a pilot. So after my second year at the academy, I left and returned home to Houston. I was accepted to Rice University. And the reason I chose to go to school at Rice, because when I was a boy, 14, 15, I used to sell soft drinks at Rice University football games. And I remember dreaming, watching the students going back to their camp, to their dorms, dreaming about what it would be like to be a Rice student, because it's a private university, very small. It's got less than 4,000 undergrads. And it was just my dream as a young boy, thinking, well, this will never happen. So transferred to Rice. There I befriended people who were majoring in politics, social, political science. So I said, okay, I'll go to law school, because they were going to go to law school. I did well at Rice, graduated with honors, and so I was able to get in some very good schools, and ultimately decided I wanted to go to Harvard because it's Harvard, and because I'd never spent any time in Boston or Cambridge, and I thought that would be a fun experience. So I went to Harvard, graduated, but I wanted to come back to Texas. As I said, I love Texas, and so I was fortunate enough to get a job, an offer from Benson Elkins, which is a large law firm in Houston, I think over 300 lawyers. Went to Benson Elkins, learned how to be a lawyer. And then in the early 1990s, I met George W. Bush, and that relationship fundamentally transformed the trajectory of my life. So that's the early part of my life.
And weren't you a partner in the law firm?
I was a partner, and in fact, I turned down an opportunity to work in George H.W. Bush's administration because the firm had never had a minority partner, and I wanted to be the first. So I stayed was made partner. And then a few years after that is when Bush runs for governor. I was asked, I'd only met him one time. I was asked during the campaign if I would host a reception for him at my law firm at Benson Elkins. And he came and he spoke, he gave his usual campaign speech. And I thought, what a great guy. I thought he's fantastic, but I thought he had no chance of being Ann Richards, who was the incumbent Democratic governor. Okay. Of course he did win. And about 2 weeks after that, as I said, he called one of my partners and said, hey, would you see if Al Gonzalez would be interested in coming to work for me as my lawyer? So I go up to Austin 2 weeks after that. We have a great conversation. And then at the end, I said, Governor, I have to ask you, why me? You don't know me. There are 60,000 lawyers in Texas. Why me? And he tells me the story that in 88, in fact, he says, I know you went up to Washington to interview for jobs in my dad's administration. And he said, you turned down my old man for a job. And that's how you got on my radar screen. So I knew that was the first time that I really experienced the fact that he was incredible with names and faces. And this is what made him such a great politician. People generally, they're attracted to him because he's that way. And Bush and I hit it off. He's the son of a president. I'm a son of a construction worker. I think he just loved my story. It's the American story. And there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of stories like that across the country that I've discovered, as I'm sure you have, Danny. And particularly in the Hispanic community, people coming from very poor backgrounds and because of America, being given an opportunity, being able to do just incredible things in this country. And so that is certainly was my story, has been my story, will continue to be my story. I'm incredibly proud to be an American. And I get angry when I hear people talk about how we're becoming a third world country, for example. I tell them, go live in that country for a year, come back and you tell me whether or not we're becoming a third world country. I regret that. I think particularly young people today don't realize how lucky they are to be in this country. I mean, the opportunities and privileges that they have. And I think that's a shame. And we all of us, you and me and listeners of this podcast, I think ought to, you know, make a special effort when they talk to young people to remind them. People died to give them an opportunity, you know, and they need to appreciate that and understand that. And if you get a chance, travel the world and you'll see for yourself how great this country is. There's some obviously great allies and friends around the world and good for them. But I'm terribly proud that I'm an American and I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the work and sacrifices of my parents. I'm grateful for the opportunities given to me by George W. Bush and others. And I'm just proud. And I'm hopeful that people will listen to this podcast with you and they'll be motivated to get with it, take advantage of the opportunities that they have and make America, you know, even better than it is today.
Oh, I totally agree with everything you just said. You know, we've talked, you know, my background. I grew up on welfare in the streets of Brooklyn in a broken home. And, you know, my mom never went to school at all. She never learned to read or write. But as you said, we're incredibly fortunate to be born in the one country where maybe the outcome may not be guaranteed, but the opportunity is. So, I totally agree. And we've got to be grateful for everyone who's served in uniform to protect our liberties and our freedoms. And keep those opportunities alive for future generations. So I thank you for your military service and everything else that you've done in your career. And, you know, let's go back to what you, so after you spoke to then Governor Bush and he asked you to be his lawyer in Texas, you went on to also do other great things in Texas government.
Yeah, after I was his general counsel for 3 years. And then, the Secretary of State position opened up, and I was sort of a natural because the portfolio included border issues with Mexico. And so being a Hispanic, and so Bush appointed me as the Secretary of State. And that was a fabulous job. One of the benefits of it was that, you know, you entertain foreign dignitaries. At the time, word was starting getting around that Bush was doing great things in Texas and maybe he ought to run for president in 2000. So that people from around the country, around the world were coming to Texas to meet with him. And so I got to be a part of that. And that it was a lot of fun. Still being part of the governor's staff, but holding a constitutional office in Texas was a lot of fun. And then one day I'm traveling and I get word that Raul Gonzalez, who was the only Hispanic and the only Democrat on the Supreme Court at the time, was going to step down. Well, knowing Bush, how he felt about the minority community, I knew that he would want to replace Raul with a Hispanic. And I thought, I wonder if he's going to think about me. And sure enough, the next day, Bush was hosting the energy minister from Mexico at a breakfast at the governor's mansion. And as Secretary of State, I was at that breakfast. And after breakfast, Bush says, come on upstairs, I want to talk to you. So I go upstairs and Governor Bush says, you know, would you like to go on the Supreme Court? And my immediate response was, do you want me to go on the Supreme Court? And he laughs and he says, that's not what I want. Do you want to go on the court? And I was very candid with him. I said, you know, Governor, I've never tried a case. You know, I'm not a litigator, and certainly I've never been. I have no judicial experience, and so I honestly worried whether or not. Not so much that I couldn't do the job. I felt that if I worked hard, I could be successful. But I kind of worried about how people would view that appointment. Would people think less of him, and maybe even less of me for the appointment? Mm-hmm. We both agreed that I would have the opportunity to think about it. And so I talked to my advisors, people I knew around the state that I respected, and asked them what they thought. And everyone, it was universal that I needed to do this. It would help me in my career long-term. It would help Bush. And so I accepted the appointment, and I was on the court for 2 years. In Texas, when you're appointed to fill a vacancy, you serve until the next general election. Mm-hmm. The next general election was going to be 2000. And of course, in 2000 is when Bush was on the ballot to run for president. And so I'm on the ballot at the same time. We're both running for office. Of course, I went in a landslide because I drew no Democratic opposition. I drew a Libertarian. But nonetheless, I campaigned. And from time to time, I would run into Bush during his campaign for president. And I remember a few months before the election, Clay Johnson, who was the appointments director and was Bush's roommate in college, called me to say, I'm in charge of the transition and I'm putting together the initial team. So we're looking for a lawyer. It's got to be someone that's a good lawyer, someone that Bush trusts and knows well. Honestly, it's got to be you. Would you do this? And I told him, I gave him the diplomatic answer. Well, I got to go home and talk to my wife about it. But I knew immediately if I had a chance to work in the White House for the President of the United States, I was going to go. So I talked to Becky. Of course, we said yes. And then we campaigned. And then, of course, election night came. And I've been told that when the election's over, that Bush is going to call me to offer me the job. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I win. On election night, there's no resolution of the presidential election because of Florida.
Right.
And the recount that was going to happen. But the next day, nonetheless, Bush calls me and he congratulates me on the victory. And he says, listen, when this is over, this will be over in a few days. Of course, it lasted several weeks. He said, when this is over, we're going to go to Washington and you're going to be White House counsel. And it was a very exciting moment. And I was so proud that even though it was in the middle of this recount, he thought enough to call me to say, okay, congratulations. And you're going to go to Washington when this is over. And of course we watched carefully like all Americans around the country on the recount. And I think the day after December 26, I remember getting on a charter jet with other Bushies to go to Washington to begin the transition. And it was so exciting, unbelievably exciting. To be in that position and to have the opportunity to serve this country, to serve with President Bush. And, a few months after taking office, well, not a few months, but several months, we had 9/11. And to work in the White House as a lawyer, first of all, is an incredible privilege and it's exciting. But to do it during a historic time, Danny, you know, I couldn't have scripted it any better to be involved in some of the more controversial, consequential legal decisions and being a part of all that. It was just very, very special time. I'm just grateful to have had the opportunity to do that because of my education, because of the hard work of my parents and friends and opportunities that people gave me. As you know, you need that. You need to be given opportunities, and there's nothing wrong with taking advantage of those opportunities. You need those kind of breaks. That helps sometimes to, and then you step up, you do a good job, and that hopefully leads to more opportunities. And that's exactly what happened for me.
I want to dive deeper into those experiences, you know, particularly the times after 9/11, but I'm going to go back to your education for a little bit because you're an incredibly smart person. I've enjoyed every conversation we've ever had, but as you said, you grew up poor in Texas. How were you able to get into Rice and Harvard? Were there scholarships? What were you able to take advantage of? Loans?
Certainly scholarships played a difference. Now, of course, it was a different time, but I graduated from Rice, I think, owing less than $1,000. Okay. Mm. All right. And I graduated from Harvard owing $13,000. My GI Bill, I did have GI Bill benefits, mm-hmm. and it ran out my last semester in law school. And it was like God, it was providence. It was God's will. This was God's plan because everything worked out for me. Because I got scholarships from Rice, but some loans, but those, you know, again, less than $3,000 is what I owed Rice University. And there was never any question, or I never really worried about the financial part of it. And I was just very, very fortunate.
That's great.
It was very helpful.
Yeah, we encourage all of our veterans to take full advantage of the GI Bill, whether they're trying to get a degree or, you know, unfortunately, you can't use the GI Bill too much for credentials and certifications, even though that's where the workforce is moving towards.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very important point to make. You know, for some people, when they get out of high school, you know, they don't know where to go, whether they should go to college. For some people, college isn't the right answer. Right. Sometimes, you know, going to a good school where they get a certificate, trade school, is the right answer. And the truth of the matter is sometimes it's going to be easier to get a job in that profession. And I consider those jobs professions. It's just a question of what is right for you and what opportunities you have. There are a lot of unemployed people that have college degrees, right? And so it's not necessary, I think, to be successful or to be considered successful in this country if you don't go to college. There are many ways you can be successful.
I totally agree. Okay, let's go back to your role in the federal government. I remember where I was during 9/11. I was in during my telecom days, and I was in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, about to meet with executives at Telmex when everything went down. Where were you?
I was in Norfolk, Virginia, giving a speech to a group of government ethics lawyers. And I flew out of Dulles that morning. The reason I mentioned Dulles is because I flew out within an hour of American 77 that flew out of Dulles. That was a plane that was hijacked and crashed into the Pentagon. So I probably was in the terminal at the same time as the hijackers. So anyway, I'm traveling with my lawyers. I was White House counsel and I have a staff of about 14 lawyers. By the time I get to the hotel where I'm going to give a speech, the first tower has been hit, and I'm on the phone with my deputy who's in the situation room, and we're not quite sure what's going on. So, you know, I decide I'm going to go ahead and give my speech. I give my speech. By that time, a second tower had been hit. So we knew immediately we were under attack. And we knew it was Al-Qaeda because, quite frankly, Danny, that summer there was a lot of chatter in our intelligence about Al-Qaeda was planning. They wanted to do something spectacular, but not within the United States, that it would be somewhere else around the world. So we knew this had to be Al-Qaeda. And so I'm on the phone. We're having trouble communicating because the telephones were overloaded. And Bush is in Florida. He started his days at an elementary school, as you remember. And I felt that I needed to be back at my post before the commander in chief got back. So we raced to the airport. Of course, by the time we get there, all the flights have been canceled and I'm stranded. And we find a USO at the airport in Norfolk, Virginia. And we find an Navy officer who's stationed at Norfolk Naval Station. And she says, I'll drive you to Norfolk. Maybe they can help you. So we go there and they go take me to the base commander, you know, and I show up and I plead my case. Please, can you help me get back to to D.C.? And of course, he's transitioning his base into the highest state of alert, canceling leaves. People are coming back. They don't know whether or not they're going to be under attack. And so here are these two yahoos from Washington. They stick us in a room with a TV and we watch like everyone else, the tower's fallen. And finally, an officer comes in, the commander comes in and says, okay, we're going to try to fly you guys back in a Navy helicopter. Where do you want us to take you? And I said, well, give me as close as you can to the White House. And he says, what if we land you on the South Lawn? And sort of immediately I flinch. I said, wow. I said, no one but the President of the United States lands on the South Lawn. And I also worried that if someone made a mistake and sees a helicopter heading towards the White House, we would get shot down. Mm-hmm. So we agreed that they would take us to Andrews Air Force Base, which is where they hang, of course, Air Force One. And about 1 o'clock that afternoon, we finally got clearance to fly back to Washington. We landed Andrews. It was a White House van to pick us up. I remember we drove by the Capitol on the way back, and it was deserted. It was except for people in the military with machine guns. It was very surreal. We get back to the White House. I immediately go to there's a bunker in the East Wing, an underground bunker in the East Wing of the White House, and that's where Cheney and the other leadership was. So I go there and we try to figure out what are the legal issues. I began communicating with my lawyers who are now in a commercial building off the White House grounds. And we began looking at the legal issues. What authorities did the president have? For example, one of the main questions we had, could the president order the military Air Force jets to shoot down commercial airliners that were headed toward sensitive targets? And that was an important decision that had to be made. Finally, about 7 o'clock, we got word that Bush was coming home. And, you know, I've had some pretty remarkable experiences, but the thing that I'll never forget is standing on the Oval Office porch with Karen Hughes, a communications director, and watching as Marine One brings Bush home that day. Normally, when with a Marine One movement, as you probably know, there are visitors on the Grand South Lawn to greet the president, to see the president off or see the president arrive. A lot of media there, people, cameras. That evening, there was just one camera crew and a bunch of agents with, black uniforms with machine guns forming a perimeter around the South Lawn. And Karen Hughes and I, we watched as Bush came home, and both of us worked for him in Texas. I was very curious about what I would see in his face. We know him pretty well. Mm-hmm. We greeted him as he approached us. We were on the Oval Office porch. He approached us and he just nodded. He just walked right by us. And behind the Oval Office, for your listeners, is a small dining room and a small study. We go into the small study, and there we're greted by Condi Rice, National Security Advisor, Andy Card, the Chief of Staff, and R.A. Flash, the Press Secretary. And we began working on the president's speech. And we also talked about what each of us had experienced that day. And then finally, about, I think, 9 o'clock, Bush gives his speech to the nation, and then I go home. And then I come back the next morning about 6:30, and it was as we all know, it was a brand new world. So that was my day. And you're right. Everyone of our age certainly has a memory, and particularly those who serve in the military, they have a memory about that day. And many people who gallantly served our country did so because they were motivated by what happened that day. And that is one of the great features of American soldiers. I mean, these individuals who see danger and see it as their duty to defend America. And we saw a lot of that happen after 9/11.
Well, and President Bush, who is the last president who was also a veteran, he was an Air Force veteran.
Yeah.
And my fear, my concern is that Americans start to forget where we were in the aftermath of 9/11. The dread, the fear, the trauma that the country experienced.
And there are two things I would say about that. One, you're absolutely right. We were concerned about a second attack, but it brought us together. Remember Tom Daschle hugging Bush when he first addressed Congress after the attack. Clarence Thomas, this is an interesting story. One of my lawyers in the counsel's office, clerk Clarence Thomas, and knows him pretty well. But she was telling a story that as Bush was leaving, he says in his baritone voice, "Ride tall in the saddle, buddy." This is what Clarence Thomas tells Bush as he's leaving the Capitol after that initial address. But it brought the country together. And sometimes I wonder, will it take another attack like that to bring us together again? I hope not. I hope it doesn't take that, because we don't need the attack. And I'd like to think that we can figure out a way to come together without that kind of event. But I was proud of the way that we respond. I was proud about the way Bush responded. As far as he was concerned, his priority, his number one job, is to protect America. A lot of things that we were going to work on, like immigration reform, All that went by the wayside. Obviously, he was concerned about the budget, but we were going to spend whatever it took to protect America and to hold responsible those who engaged in the attack. So it fundamentally transformed the Bush presidency. we made mistakes, I think. I think it's fair to say we made mistakes in some of the things that how we responded. But I can say with pride that we kept America safe.
Yeah, hear, hear. Well, and then in the aftermath of that, then eventually you become Attorney General. How did that take place? And let's talk about your services. Again, I think it's the highest ranking Hispanic and Latino ever in the executive branch of the U.S. government, right?
Yeah, and I'm the only lawyer in American history who's been both White House counsel and Attorney General. And there's a good reason for that, which I can explain shortly. But, you know, I'd been in state service, and then it was 4 years working as White House counsel. And I came home one day towards the end of the first term, and Becky, my wife, says, "We're broke. You need to leave government service and go back into private practice, because we just can't afford to do this anymore. You know, it's expensive to live in Washington, and we lived in Northern Virginia, but it's expensive." And I'd been at it for a while. And so she was telling me, "We can't do this anymore." And I remember the next morning going to see the president. And it's kind of embarrassing to tell the president, "I don't have enough, you know, we're broke." But I told him, I was very candid with him. And he looked at me when I told him we were, you know, and had to leave. He said, "Well, that's not going to happen." He said, "I've got plans for you and a second term, and we're going to have a second term." And, you know, this was not long before the election. And so I went home and told my wife, the president says that I'm not leaving. And thinking about what his plans were, I felt it only could be two things. One, he was going to put me on the court because it was speculation. Bush wanted to be the president to put the first Hispanic on the court.
Right.
And I'd been a justice, but there hadn't been a vacancy. And who knew when there would be a vacancy? So the whole first term, Bush didn't have an opportunity to fill a vacancy on the court. The other obvious choice was to be attorney general. The role of the White House counsel, you interface with the Department of Justice all the time on legal issues. So John Ashcroft and I obviously developed a close relationship. We were very different, but I have to tell you, that guy was a warrior for President Bush in terms of doing what we had to do within the law, but very aggressive in taking the steps that we needed to protect America. So I felt that, okay, I think that's what he plans to do. And as you remember, the race against Kerry, the election against Kerry, wasn't called until the next morning because of Ohio. It was a very close outcome in Ohio, and because it went Bush's way, you know, he's now been reelected. And that later that morning, he calls me into the Oval Office, and you know, Bush used to, he was I think the general partner, an owner of the Texas Rangers. So he often spoke in sports metaphors.
Sure.
So I walk into the Oval Office and he says, "Get your uniform on, you're going in." And so I knew, he said, "You're going to become Attorney General." And I thanked him and I immediately called my wife. And so that's how it happened. And this was, of course, in November. And my confirmation hearing happened, I think, January 5th. And the vote, I was confirmed February 4th. And I remember I was in the counsel's office. My office had been all packed up. There were boxes. And immediately after I was confirmed, the FBI, the agents came into my office and they kind of stood guard there. And I first called Bush. Mm-hmm. To thank him. And then I called Ashcroft to thank him for his service. And then the FBI agents, we went down to the street. I get in the Suburbans. They take me to the Department of Justice. And I walk into this office. It's really got nothing in there, but I'm the Attorney General of the United States. And that's how it all began. It was really, really kind of cool.
So, and you were able to serve with distinction, but also there were some issues. What was your experience like as Attorney General? What was the highlights, lowlights?
Yeah, it is a great privilege to be a cabinet secretary, particularly, you know, the Attorney General's driven around in black Suburbans with FBI agents with machine guns, and you fly around the world in a G5 jet. So it's, but it's hard. It was an incredibly hard experience because every decision you make, there are winners and losers. And you go up to the Hill a lot to testify, oversight hearings, justify the decisions you make. And there's a lot of press. You deal with the media all the time. And so you're always on. One of the things I enjoyed about being White House counsel is I would virtually every day talk to the president or see the president. I might go a week or two without seeing the president as attorney general. I may go days without talking with him. And so it wasn't quite the same. It was a very kind of different thing. But to be the chief law enforcement officer of the country is an incredible privilege. And I did it for 3 years. And you're right. What happened with me is some of the decisions that were made under the Ashcroft regime became controversial, like interrogation, surveillance, Geneva, Guantanamo. And because I had been White House counsel, they couldn't haul me up to testify when I was White House counsel. But as AG, I had to testify all the time. And so I sort of got tagged with being responsible for all of that. And then, of course, at the end of the first term, the White House made some decisions based upon my recommendation to remove some U.S. attorneys. Mm-hmm. That happens all the time with respect to a new term. And so, but that became controversial. And so I'd have to say that certainly my last year as attorney general was pretty difficult in terms of, because by then the Democrats had taken control of the Senate. That's the thing that made a big difference. When they got control of the Senate, people like Chuck Schumer, Pat Leahy, they really came after me pretty hard.
That's unfortunate. And that's when the unity started to fray a little bit, right?
A little bit. I think so. That's right. But I'm not, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm being a crybaby. public service should not be as difficult as it is sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I do tell my students, I encourage them to pursue public service when they graduate from Belmont Law School. But go in with your eyes open and your armor on. Because it can be brutal. It can be cruel at times, and it shouldn't be that way. But we need to have good people still encouraged to serve in the highest levels of government.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because I think you're absolutely right. I think government service and public service in general is so not only important, but incredibly rewarding in many respects too. And then you talked about your students at Belmont. I want to get into that a little bit, but I was curious. You've got three kids, right? So during your time at the White House and at the Justice Department, were they little or?
Yes, they were, but by the time I left, they were in grade school. But I'm funny you asked this, because I remember every morning the Suburbans would show up at my house to take me to work. The first day I was no longer Attorney General, I remember looking out the window, seeing if the Suburbans were there, knowing that they wouldn't be there, but nonetheless seeing if they were there. And I drove my sons to the bus stop. And it was the first time I'd ever done that. And I realized then how much I had missed.
Yeah.
That is really the ultimate sacrifice, is time away from family. And we have three boys. They're all great young men. Maybe I would say they're not so young anymore, given my age, but they've turned out great. And my wife deserves all the credit. I mean, she was there raising the boys. And so I could do what I felt needed to be done to serve our country. But I tell our students as well that whatever you do, no matter how important you get, always look back at your family, hold them close, because when your so-called friends, when your time gets tough, your so-called friends disappear.
Yeah.
It's always going to be your family and your close friends who are going to be with you no matter what happens. So developing those relationships is incredibly important and necessary in these kinds of jobs. So the higher you go, it becomes even more necessary to develop close relationships. You're going to have a lot of so-called friends, but those relationships, as soon as you're no longer important, they disappear.
That's right.
And when times get tough, they're not there. It's the family and the close friends that are really important.
And you're so right about family. It's just like military service. You're away from your family a lot, but which is why at Alva we always say that, you know, military service is not necessarily an individual exercise. It really is a family endeavor.
Total sacrifice. Absolutely. Yeah.
it's a sacrifice. And that's why membership is free to active duty veterans, you know, and their family members, right? Because we can't do what we do either in the military or in public service without the support of our family. So, you know, God bless them.
Absolutely.
So let's talk now then about life after your roles in federal government and life after your role as Attorney General.
I had options to do various things. One of the big decisions I made was I didn't want to go back into private practice so much. I'd done that. I'd been a partner. So I chose academia because it felt right to be involved in training the next generation of leaders. That's the way I look at my role today. I'm playing a small part in preparing the next generation of leaders. And I often talk when talking to our students here or whenever I travel the country and have the opportunity to talk to young people, I emphasize several things. America's great, one of the greatest, if not, you know, one of the greatest countries in the world. We all have an obligation to protect the legacy that we were born with and find time during your life, during your career to give back. And there are many, many ways, as you know, to give back. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one of the greatest sacrifice we made is to go serve in our military. But there are many ways to give back. And, you know, we try to emphasize that you have a lifetime to make money. You have mm-hmm. a lifetime to make money. And so we try to encourage that in our students. And anybody that I talk with that's willing to listen to me, I remind them, you know, how important it is to give back.
So how long have you been at Belmont?
I've been at Belmont since 2012. It's been a while. The school's been good to us. Two of our sons are Belmont graduates. My wife is a Belmont graduate.
That's awesome.
They've really been good to us. They've taken care of us. We live in Belmont is in Nashville, Tennessee. This is a very exciting place, particularly for a young person. Downtown Nashville on Broadway on a weekend, it's crazy. This is, I think, the capital for a bridal shower, bridal, whatever they call it. It's a good place to be. Obviously, country music is huge. The Grand Ole Opry is here. In fact, Belmont's first graduation, our commencement speaker was Sam Alito. And Becky and I, my wife, we took Sam and Martha, his wife, to the Grand Ole Opry when they were here. So it's a fun place. I'm going to be buried in the state cemetery in Texas. I've already got my plot laid out. I love Texas, but we're going to retire here in, I think, in Tennessee. We really are very happy here.
You know, I've never been. I've got to get to Nashville.
Well, I would invite you, please come and let us come, and we're happy to host you. And I think you would enjoy it. It's a nice place to visit.
That's awesome. So I would be remiss if I didn't take a couple minutes for us to talk a little bit of politics. I mean, we've talked about the war on terror. We've talked about service in the federal government. We've talked about service in the military. But I often say that we are the strongest nation the world has ever known. We've got the strongest military. There's not a single external force that can take us down. The only thing that can take us down is our own internal division. And it's for me, as someone who loves this country and loves everything that we stand for as a nation, I am truly concerned about the level of division, tribalism, polarization that we're seeing today. What are your thoughts about the state of politics right now in this country?
They're a mess. You're right. But, you know, I think I heard someone, I was listening to someone once not too long ago talking about how the state of politics reflects a few months, maybe is a few months behind where the state of the people are. So to the extent that our politics is divided, it's because the American people are divided. And, you know, I'm hopeful that enough that there are transformational leaders out there that will come forward and be able to unite. You're not going to get agreement on everything, but on the important things, I think we can still reach agreement. But that's going to involve being willing to compromise. It's also going to involve being willing to listen. the level of incivility mm-hmm. in this country is very disappointing and dangerous, and it makes it impossible to make progress on some of the very difficult issues that we have to deal with today. So I'm worried, but I am very optimistic. I suspect I'm like you, Danny. I know how great this country is, and we've been through tough times before. The Civil War, Vietnam. I mean, there are a number of instances where people thought, my goodness, is this the end of America? There is no guarantee that America will exist forever. Mm-hmm. Nope, no guarantee. It requires work. And I remain convinced that there are people out there that are willing to do the work, to make the sacrifice, so that America continues and it's pretty much in its current form.
Yeah, I think people take what we have for granted way too much. They don't recognize that, you know, our republic, our democracy is very tenuous. It's based on a constitution. It's based on folks who are able to enter into a collective bargain. It's based on institutions that we can all trust and believe in. It's very fragile. So, I mean, it's going to take leadership to be able to get us back to where we need to be to make sure that we are sustainable as a notion.
Absolutely. And as a result of that, like you identify, it requires a special kind of leadership. And that's, I think, the quandary that people are in today in terms of looking at the two main candidates who are running for president. In their own way, they're unique. In their own way, they're deeply flawed. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's caused many people that I talk to wonder, we're a nation of, what, 370 or so million. To provide this choice to the American people is very bewildering to a lot of people. Like, how did we get here? And I know that there are fans for both candidates, and I get that. I'm very worried about this election. Now, does that mean that I'm going to sit out? No, I'm going to make a choice. I've got to decide what choice to make. But I think all of us have an obligation. I hope everyone understands and appreciates. Yeah, this is a historic period, and we have a historic obligation, I think, to get educated and to make a choice that you think is best for yourself and your family. But we can't just put our head in the sand and say, oh, this is so bad, I want no part of it. I think that's the wrong approach, Danny. I think we gotta, people like yourself, you know, you have to give other people like me opportunities to talk about what's going on and to remind everyone they have an obligation as a citizen of this country to get educated, to take a position, and to go vote in particular. But I have no idea how this is going to turn out. No idea.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. But I think, you know, to the extent that each individual can look beyond just the color of the jersey, if you will, to use another sports metaphor, and, you know, make sure that we're able to see beyond just what's in the news and capturing the headlines and so forth, that what can they do as an individual to make our nation stronger, freer, more prosperous? What can we do to make our society more fair, more equal, more just, and encourage others to model peace, love, unity, kindness, you know, the types of things that that really matter at the end of the day for human beings and human interaction. But I think having that mindset of coming together, I mean, look, I mean, I miss the days when Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan would be able to get a drink, you know, leaders of opposite parties. I mean, we need to be able to have, get back to a time where consensus and compromise weren't dirty words.
You're absolutely right. And I don't know whether or not these two individuals, I don't know. I am a little bit worried, but I still have confidence that we're going to get through this. You know, because we have to.
We have to.
We are America, and that's just what we do, right? That's what
we
do.
Here, here. Well, Al, listen, I've I can't tell you how much I appreciate your thoughts, your wisdom, your words, your time, your service. If you don't mind, I'm going to give you an opportunity just to take a few seconds to be able to share some final thoughts and some pearls of wisdom with our audience before we wrap up.
Well, if I may, I'd rather just say thank you to the veterans. When I speak to people, I often talk about name a country who's given more sons and daughters to secure freedom, not for our own freedom, but freedom in foreign lands. That's who we are. That is what the veterans have done. It kept us safe, but more than that, kept other countries around the world safe. And so we owe our veterans, putting me aside, but we owe our veterans, you know, such gratitude. For what they allow us to pursue our dreams. And for many of them, they come back wounded, either physically or mentally. Families are torn apart, but nonetheless, that's what they do. And that's always been true for us. I hope that will continue to be true going forward, but I just want to salute the veterans.
Hear, hear.
And those in the military today, of course.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. And I join you in those sentiments. And I thank you again for sharing with us today, Al. And I look forward to staying in touch. And thank you for serving on our advisory council. And definitely going to take you up on that offer to visit you in Nashville.
Okay. Thanks, Danny.
And on behalf of the American Latino Veterans Association, thank you all for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed the content. Please join us for future webinars and podcasts. Please keep an eye out for information on upcoming events by visiting our website, alvavets.org, and our social media channels at alvavets. Thank you once again to Al for being our special guest speaker today. Thank you to our sponsors for these podcasts and webinars, JP Morgan Chase, PMI, Wells Fargo, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Accenture. Thank you all again for joining us. And as always, be safe, aim high, and thrive. We'll see you next time. Thanks again.